The Guardian.
Keir Starmer has faced many challenges in his first year as Labour leader, but he hasn't been tested at the ballot box. On May the 6th, that will change. I'm Raphael Baer, columnist for The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
Since the historic victory of 1945, there have only been three Labour winners. I want to be the fourth.
On April the 4th last year, Sir Keir Rodney Starmer comfortably won the election to succeed Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the Labour Party. But that, it turns out, was the easy bit. How would he unite a party that had spent the previous 5 years in bitter factional feuding? How would he introduce himself to a country that had just delivered Labour its lowest tally of MPs in an election since 1935? What would be his mission? And how could he get Labour's lost voters to listen? Those were tough enough problems even before the UK was plunged into an epoch-defining public health emergency. And that didn't leave much political bandwidth for the opposition. So how's it going? Labour opinion is divided. Wider public opinion has been up and down. A little more down in recent months. But that's just opinion polls. In May, voters will have a say in local and devolved elections and a critical by-election in Hartlepool. But it isn't just the Tories hoping to capitalise on Labour's ongoing difficulty. The Green Party sees an opportunity to pounce and pick up a few council seats. Peter Walker explores that later on in the show. Meanwhile, Brexit. It still isn't done. 3 months after the UK-Brussels trade deal came into effect, Lisa O'Carroll speaks to the EU ambassador to the UK about the Northern Ireland Protocol, unilateralism, and what vaccine he ended up getting. That's all coming up in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, regular listeners might be surprised to find me in the host's chair, but both Heather and Jessica are off this week, so I'm very gladly stepping in. Now, there wasn't a big party to celebrate Keir Starmer's first year as Labour leader. That sort of thing isn't allowed these days. But even without social distancing rules, there isn't a very festive mood around the party as it faces its first big electoral test since December 2019. And if that doesn't go well, people will increasingly wonder, what is the point of Keir Starmer? To help answer that and other questions, I'm joined by Guardian columnist Gabby Hinsliffe. Gabby, nice to have you on the podcast. How are you?
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Excellent. Now, let's get straight down to business. Back in January, you wrote a piece about Keir Starmer where you pointed out that his decency and competence, or the impression of decency and competence that he gave, had been quite effective, but probably weren't enough, especially not if Boris Johnson managed to turn around his own reputation for incompetent handling of the pandemic. And he kind of seems to have pulled that off with the vaccine rollout. So how stuck is Keir Starmer now facing a government on the bounce?
Boris Johnson is a lucky general, you have to say. I mean, after the early fairly horrendous mistakes in handling the pandemic, he's been sort of saved by the vaccine, saved by scientists, saved by, to be honest, things largely beyond his control. And that has put Starmer in a very awkward position. I mean, so long as the Prime Minister was screwing up and screwing up on something that, you know, consumed everything. There was no other politics for a year, pretty much. So we focused in a way that we don't normally focus on leadership rather than on the issues. You're looking at not on a party's ideological stance on issues of the day, but you were looking at leadership. Who do you trust of these two men to, you know, look after you and your family? Who do you think cares? Who do you think takes the threat seriously? Who do you think knows what they're doing on a day-to-day basis? The most dedicated Johnson supporter in the world couldn't say that, you know, Johnson's strengths were competence and caring and, you know, taking things enormously seriously. So by contrast, Starmer looked good. And, you know, that's what we saw. That was largely what was driving and Labour's rise in the polls. You know, we had a very clear change with the Corbyn regime. And, you know, you saw people dissatisfied with their current Prime Minister looking for an alternative. But that's not happening anymore. And just not being, in the same way that not being Corbyn is not in itself enough, not being Boris Johnson is not in itself enough. You know, you're now at the stage where people are going, OK, well, we know who you're not. What are you exactly?
There are two elements to this, aren't there? So it's always hard in a crisis where the opposition are sort of expected to sort of row in behind the national effort and somehow support the government. And obviously a lot of the opposition supporters don't want them to be supporting the government. They want them to be opposing. And that opens up this broader challenge that I think Labour have in particular, which is you have to sort of keep your activist base excited and energized, and they like radical ideas, and a lot of them are Corbyn supporters and like radical left ideas. And you also got to reach out to target voters who are more skeptical of that radicalism and, you know, for want of a better word, are basically a bit more conservative in their worldview. And that's just a really difficult tightrope walk. So how do you feel Starmer is performing on that exercise?
It's a bit wobbly in tightrope terms, isn't it? That's the trouble. I mean, the pandemic, as you say, has been hard, but almost the post-pandemic phase is harder because that's when other issues begin to re-enter. You know, domestic politics begins to re-enter the fray. And on that, you know, on most of the sort of big domestic issues, those two sides of the Labour Party are much more dramatically opposed than they were on pandemic handling. I mean, broadly, yes, there might have been arguments about how much you should be attacking the government versus how much you shouldn't. But, you know, there was broad consensus probably within the Labour Party about the right way to deal with COVID. There is absolutely not broad consensus about how to deal with some of the other issues now arising. And that's where it gets difficult. You know, he's developed a bit of a reputation for sitting on the fence, for abstaining rather than opposing in Parliament, for flip-flopping one way on the other, for indicating to one group of people that he's here and to another that he's there, you know, and that contributes to the sort of sense of ambiguity or lack of clarity about what he stands for, which comes through in focus groups all the time. You know, they're not quite sure who he is. They're not quite sure where he's going. And the trouble is, any choice he makes is going to offend someone within the Labour Party. And there's a point as a new leader where you have the authority to do that. You know, when you're ahead, when you're winning, everything's easy. When you're ahead in the polls, you have the authority to say, actually, I know this is going to annoy half the party, but we're doing this. And you fall in behind me because, look, it's working. The minute it stops looking like it's working, you know, you start sliding backwards in the polls. You no longer have the authority to do that. And it gets harder to make the choices that you have to make.
I wonder if there's an extent to which Starmer squandered the moment of maximum opportunity to really define himself with regard to his predecessor, which was immediately after having won. He could perhaps have said, right, we've got to properly move on from that whole Corbyn thing. A lot of things went badly wrong then. But that wasn't the campaign that he fought for the leadership, was it? He sort of pledged a bit of continuity. He didn't repudiate Corbyn then. He sort of was then bounced into a bit of repudiation later. He sacked Rebecca Long-Bailey. Jeremy Corbyn is no longer technically a Labour MP, doesn't take the whip anymore. But I wonder, what's your sense of whether that's something he needs to still do to actually say, to give definition to a Starmer project in confrontation, frankly, with what the Corbyn project was, to signal to voters that it really is under new management?
Yeah, I mean, when you say a bit of repudiation, I mean, the fact that Jeremy Corbyn's no longer a Labour MP, that's quite a lot of repudiation, to be fair. But it wasn't something, you know, in a sense, it wasn't something, or it was something he chose to do, but it was Corbyn who manoeuvred himself, put himself in a position where, you know, the leader was forced to choose. So some voters might still think, well, I'm still unsure, you know, what you intended by that. I think the problem is more that he signalled that he's moved on from, you know, the Corbyn era, but it's not clear that we've moved on what we've moved on to, because there was a large part of the Labour membership that voted for him thinking, you know, we liked a lot of the Corbyn policies, but we accept that Corbyn himself was anathema to large parts of the electorate. So what we want is a better Jeremy. We want someone who confront those policies in a more convincing way that sells them to people who didn't get it beforehand. And he never said anything during the leadership campaign that would have shaken that faith, you know, that would have made you think that wasn't what he intended. And then you have a situation where he becomes leader and suddenly, you know, it's clear what, to be honest, should have been clear all along to anyone who'd looked at Starmer's record, which is that you're not getting a better Jeremy here. You're getting a different person with different ideas of their own and someone who is going to move away in policy terms from the Corbyn legacy. And that was always the problem of the campaign he fought. You can't be a unifying candidate of a party that has fundamental ideological differences and factions that are implacably opposed to each other. You know, it is not clear how you bring those two together without displeasing one side or the other. And I think one of his faults is that he finds it difficult to confront people head on. And there is going to have to be a fair bit of head on confrontation.
Right. And the point on which he basically did sack Rebecca Long Bailey and take the whip away from Jeremy Corbyn was this relatively discreet issue of anti-Semitism, where, you know, pretty much no one thinks the Labour Party should be anti-Semitic. So, you know, there's all sorts of micro arguments you can have around the handling of that issue and the definitions of it. But basically, that's quite separate to this much broader issue of, you know, as you say, something as big as economic policy, whether the Labour Party is like even, you know, for or against capitalism. I mean, huge issues. And then meanwhile, you have, you know, a Conservative Party that's ripped up its own basic economic orthodoxies. Rishi Sunak, I mean, he's a Thatcherite at heart, but with the furlough scheme, with the debt and the borrowing, he's basically, you know, parked a fiscal tank right on terrain that would have once been belonged entirely to Labour. So there's two different ways in which the leader of the Labour Party can't really get a definition for himself on very substantial issues of how political economy should work.
His challenge is going to be to remove those tanks from the lawn, because I don't think you're going to sort of transform overnight necessarily what, you know, Labour wins in that space where it's seen as being the champion and defender of public services at a time when public opinion is for public spending. You know, it's ticked that second box at the moment, which the Tories have responded to by saying, okay, we're the party of public services now. You know, we're the party that spends money, and it horrifies their own backbenches, but they know that is where they need to be politically. That should be Labour's turf. And if you look at the actual facts going forward, if you look at the projections we had in the last budget, you know, there is a rhetoric about spending money and a reality that says something different. There will be money spent on big infrastructure projects. You know, there's almost nowhere left that Boris Johnson doesn't want to build a bridge to. But you can see shrinking budgets going forward for capital spending. So Labour needs to be in a position of saying the Tories are all talk, no action. They're not going to do, you know, they talk about how much they've changed, but it's not true. You know, in reality, we're the only people you can trust. But they're not even in the foothills of beginning to make that argument. And if we are working on the assumption, as Labour seems to be doing, that it's not going to be a 2024 election, it's going to be 2023, actually something that seemed, you know, very far off in the distance, if you assume that a 2023 election, the campaign for it really begins in 2022, you know, hang on a minute, he's running out of time already.
Right, well, Boris Johnson has swerved away from at least the rhetoric of austerity, but not because he's a sudden convert to Keynesian economics, but because he had this contract with Brexit voters in former Labour seats, and he's delivered them something called Brexit, but they'll want more, and his mission now is basically to try and hose that electorate down with enough money that they feel the contract has been honoured. Now, for Labour, that is an ongoing problem, isn't it? The fact that these voters that they had taken for granted for a long time are now Johnson voters. Is Brexit still something that is going to haunt Keir Starmer? I mean, he was very associated with the calls for a second referendum. He's a liberal lawyer in a Islington seat. Is that just a structural obstacle to rebuilding what we've come to know of as the Red Wall?
On Brexit, I think the best he can hope for really is that time heals and everyone moves on. It's very much a lawyer's gambit, I think, of, you know, you fight the case all the way up to the Supreme Court, and then when the Supreme Court rules against you, which was essentially what the 2019 general election did, you accept the judgment and you move on. You've lost. But you're not, there's a whole culture associated. Brexit is not just about Europe. You know, there is a culture associated with Brexit voters that, yes, has views on Europe and, yes, has views on immigrants, but also has views on all sorts of other things, also has views on patriotism, also has views on the use of the flag, also has views on criminal justice, also has views probably on a whole load of cultural issues, although this is overplayed, I think, a lot of the time, but does have views on cultural issues like gay rights or whatever it is, you know, so, and feminism having gone too far and so on. So there's a group of views associated with Brexit voters and with Red Wall voters. That is also something that he has to grapple with.
Right. That's really interesting, that observation, I think, about his lawyerly approach to this issue, that, you know, as it were, the Supreme Court of the electorate delivered their verdict, and so it was time to concede. Because exactly as you've just said, that doesn't really grasp the extent to which the Brexit thing burrowed its way into the core of people's identities. And you described that with relation to Brexit voters, but I think that's also true of a lot of Remain voters. I wonder to what extent Keir Starmer has a kind of lack of emotional literacy around the more cultural side of politics. It was a very interesting moment. You mentioned patriotism and the flag. At the end of last year, The Guardian had this leaked strategy document that said, that advised the Labour Party to take a more consciously patriotic tone. And that was met with, I think, what could best be described as skepticism on the left. But if the opposition basically has an ambivalent relationship with its national flag, that's a real problem, isn't it? I mean, that's a problem that goes beyond just not knowing what economic policy to have. Is Starmer, as I say, is he literate in expressing these things and in a way that can basically carry the party with him?
I think if an opposition has, you know, an ambivalent or negative relationship to the national flag, that's a huge problem for a very large group of voters. If it has a sort of extremely positive or fawning relationship to the national flag, that's a problem for a smaller group of voters, but one that's very heavily concentrated in the Labour Party. So once again, it's one of those situations where for Starmer, where you can't please everyone. And actually, in those circumstances, you just have to go with what you really feel and what you really think. It needs to, you know, convey to voters that it's patriotic and that it, you know, and that it believes in Britain and it loves the country it wants to represent, because otherwise, why would you trust it to represent that country and govern that country? But it simultaneously has to, I think, pick away at the Tories' co-opting of the flag and at that sort of patriotism that's very prominently expressed by Tory cabinet ministers every time. You know, literally, we're almost at the point now where everyone, Tory cabinet minister, has to appear in public wearing Union Jack underpants over their trousers and singing Rule Britannia. But you can't hammer away at that without saying that patriotism is fake too, without saying, well, okay, you love the country so much, how come you let 130,000 people die and you're letting public services be run down to the bone? And how much, you know, patriotism is not just about gestures, it's about serving your country to the best of your abilities. And if you're not doing that, you don't have the right to use the paraphernalia.
It all suggests then that Boris Johnson doesn't really have much to be afraid of when it comes to Keir Starmer's Labour Party. If you were advising Downing Street now, is that what you would be saying, Gabby? Do you think you'd be thinking, yeah, you've probably got another term before this Labour Party gets its act together?
I don't know that I would, actually. I mean, I think that might be the most likely result, but I think they should be taking a Starmer Labour Party a lot more seriously than a Corbyn Labour Party. And I think they should also recognise, when did Starmer do well? Bluntly, when Boris Johnson cocked up. If you think that's never going to happen again, then Starmer is not a problem. On the other hand, if you think, I'm just putting that out there, that Boris Johnson is capable of screwing up in some ginormous way again before the end of this parliament, then you would do well to take your opponent seriously. I think you also need to consider, the Tory party needs to think back to one of the reasons that the last Labour government died on its feet, and it's that sense that it had become tired, it had become, you know, prone to all sorts of scandals, it had run out of ideas, it had run out of new thinking, it didn't have anything much left to offer. Sort of corruption scandals that are starting to swirl around this government now reminds you that it may be a new government, but it, you know, it's been a long stretch of Tory rule, and there's that slight exhaustion that sets in, even when you keep changing leaders as regularly as the Tories have over the last few years. You run out of steam, you run out of good people, and that can kill off a government in the end as much as the strength of its opposition.
For anyone who wants to hear more about the direction the Labour Party has taken under Keir Starmer, I strongly recommend you listen to Monday's episode of our sister podcast, Today in Focus, because Heather Stewart makes some predictions there, along with Anoushka Astana. And there'll be a link to that episode in today's show notes. But meanwhile, it just remains for me to say, Gabby Hinsliff, thank you very much for your wisdom and insight. As ever, it's a real pleasure to have you on the podcast.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
After the break, we look at how the Green Party is hoping to capitalise on a fall in form for the Labour Party. And Lisa O'Carroll speaks to the EU's ambassador to the UK. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Raphael Baer. Now, local and devolved elections are fast approaching. Normally, you'd expect the main opposition party to enjoy a midterm boost against the incumbent party of government. But these aren't normal times. And as we heard a moment ago, Keir Starmer's bandwagon has stalled. Labour's loss would be someone else's gain. But whose? Green councillors in the north of England are mobilising, hoping to pick up seats from voters on the left whose affections for the Labour Party are under strain. Again. My colleague Peter Walker spoke to a couple of those hopeful Green councillors to get some insight.
So one of the groups most likely to look to the Green Party for inspiration are young people. I decided to chat to Kai Taylor, a Green councillor for Knowsley Council in Merseyside. I was pretty shocked when I found out he was only 20 when he first won his seat. But despite a busy schedule as both a councillor and as election coordinator for the National Party, Kai is actually attempting to write a dissertation in the middle of what's going to be a very tough local campaign. Surprisingly, though, he didn't even start off as a Green.
Like a lot of Green Party members, I was originally in the Labour Party, and this was back in 2015, 16. I didn't particularly like the direction that I could see the way the Labour Party was heading. They seemed to be more focused on the battles that they had to have internally as opposed to, you know, taking the fight to the Conservative government, and felt like the Green Party offered a more progressive outlook, offered a more kind of radical idea of how we can promote change and we can promote sustainability. And I think for me, it just felt like the Green Party were in a better position to start the kind of taking the fight to the government, whilst the Labour Party seemed to be more concerned with fighting amongst themselves.
What's it been like to kind of start from scratch virtually in such a kind of strongly Labour area? Because I'm right in thinking that Knowsley is kind of Harold Wilson's former area. Has it been quite a kind of battle? Have you found people reasonably open to what you're trying to do?
Like a lot of areas, particularly in the north, you know, like the Red Wall seats, I think for so long they were just kind of taken for granted as safe Labour voters. And as a result of this, you know, in these areas, Labour kind of forget how to campaign. And even though this is an area with very, very typical Labour voters and what you assume would be a Labour stronghold, we found people to be really keen to have those conversations with us and really keen to learn more about what the Green Party stands for. And I think if one thing that the party's been really clear to put out is that, you know, there is no environmental justice without social justice. And I think that is resonating a lot more in working class communities like in Knowsley, you know, like in Burnley, like in South Yorkshire, places where we're really feeling like we can do well. We're really keen to keep getting that message across to voters and keep kind of, you know, making the case for those somewhat radical ideas that we have in terms of how we create a more equal and more fair society.
And in the local elections in May, what would count as a kind of good result?
Well, in 2019, when we had the district and borough councils up for election, we made 182 gains. This year's elections are going to be slightly different because we're fighting county council elections, which are often quite big awards, so therefore a little bit more difficult to win. We're currently on about 362 councillors across England and Wales, and we're quite confident that we'll take that number above 400 by May.
I mean, one of the things that smaller parties, and particularly the Greens, seem to find is that your local campaigning can win you council seats. But the bigger the area it is, the more the first past the post plays against you. And you have said, I'm right in thinking, you stood in the general election in 2019. And that's something that the Greens have traditionally found very difficult. You know, if you've still only got one MP. Is that a bit of a worry that people will take you seriously at local level, but when it gets to more national level, they just revert back to the big parties?
I think that's certainly a concern for a lot of Green Party campaigners and Green Party activists. I think the way that we see it is that, you know, through local elections, through having councillors elected, we build credibility, and that credibility kind of follows us into general elections. So there's 18 different councils now across England and Wales that have Green councillors in administration. You know, we've got places like Brighton and Hove, which are now run by the Green Party. The key task over the next couple of years leading up to the 2024 general election is to make sure that we continue to build on our credibility so that we pose a clear alternative to a lot of voters that will be politically homeless and won't be wanting to vote for the Labour Party or the Conservative Party. And hopefully we'll be able to make that case that we're the genuine alternative for those voters.
Now let's look at Burnley. I spoke to Andy Fewings, a Green councillor, who, because of the fairly convoluted way council elections are run, isn't up for election in the town this year, but he is running for Lancashire County Council. Andy first decided to throw his hat into the ring when he moved to Burnley in 2014 and couldn't find a party he thought spoke for his values. In the 2019 general election, Burnley turned Conservative, making him think that maybe the Greens can capitalise on a breakdown of Labour domination.
Nationally, as we go into these elections, they're mostly county seats. So we are standing against a lot of Conservatives, and we do win against Conservatives as well. But in terms of the Labour Party, and Burnley itself. You know, actually in 2010, they lost the seat to the Liberal Democrats, and in 2019, they lost the seat to the Conservatives. And I think people have stopped voting for Labour out of habit. Therefore, it makes them think about how they're going to vote. And when they do that, they find that, you know, a lot of the things that they hear about Labour nationally are not reflected in the behaviour of the local Labour Party.
Is it perhaps also that, you know, what a scene maybe from a London journalist's view is northern towns are actually not quite, you know, what the stereotype would indicate? Because am I right in thinking your husband runs a vegan cafe? Is that right? Is Burnley perhaps a bit more varied and mixed than you know some people might think?
Absolutely. I think stereotypes are what they are. You know, it's very easy to assume that there are no people that care about the environment in Burnley because it's a deprived northern town and go with that stereotype. But actually, you know, at the end of the day, people are becoming more conscious of their choices, but also are looking at politicians and saying, well, why are we in this situation where the climate emergency is so imminent? What have you been doing all this time? There is essentially a big gap because there is no one really listening to local residents and taking their concerns on board. That is the space that is meant to be filled by the Labour Party. But you can only go so many decades where the promises don't turn into results and people start looking for alternatives. And I think that, you know, people have noticed.
And I obviously realise that the Greens' offering has gone a long way in recent years beyond the kind of environmental concerns that people always used to associate with you. But obviously, these climate emergencies can be in the news an awful lot this year because Glasgow is hosting the COP26 summit later in the year. How much do you think factors like that play in the kind of elections you're taking part in? And on a personal level, do you trust the government to stick by the commitments they're going to be taking into COP26?
I mean, yeah, so I think they will have a huge factor in the elections coming up and this year and also over the next decade, really, because we are at that crunch point. What we know from the Conservatives is that they underdeliver, they overpromise and underdeliver, and they're overpromising on these issues, fall short of what we need. So we're already in a sticky situation before we've even begun.
The Guardian's Peter Walker reporting there. Now, as has often been mentioned on this podcast, relations between the UK and the EU are not exactly great. Maybe that was inevitable, given the messy Brexit breakup, but throw in a nasty vaccine dispute and trust on both sides has fallen to an all-time low. In the middle of these rows sits Northern Ireland, part of the UK stuck dealing with the fallout from decisions made about it from the outside. Over the past week, we've seen pockets of violence break out in loyalist areas. The First Minister, Arlene Foster, has argued it's due to the decision not to charge Sinn Féin members for breaking COVID restrictions when they attended the funeral of Republican Bobby Storey. Northern Ireland's Justice Minister, Naomi Long, has said the government's dishonesty over the consequences of a hard Brexit has contributed to the anger felt by loyalists. Whatever the reason, the sight of petrol bombs and cars ablaze in Northern Ireland brings back memories of much darker times and raises anxiety about the future. It seems like the right time to talk to João Faleja Almeida, the first post-Brexit EU ambassador to the UK, who took up the role at the start of February last year, not knowing that Brexit wouldn't be the only crisis to contend with. The Guardian's Brexit correspondent Lisa O'Carroll met the ambassador for the first time last January as he was being introduced to the British press in Westminster. They then caught up again on Monday.
Just to start, we should go back to the beginning. Back in January 2020, we were all told that you were going to be the EU's new ambassador to London. But I'm not sure if I can call you this. The UK refuses to recognise your diplomatic status. Is that correct?
No, you certainly can call me ambassador. No problem with that. You can call me João as well. That's fine as well. Listen, I am the EU ambassador. We're just, concluding discussions with the UK government to establish the full diplomatic status. But that doesn't prevent me from fully representing the European Union. And that's what I've been doing. It's been quite a hectic year, quite a busy year. And it's always good to look back, but it's also important to look ahead and look forward. And I think the UK and the EU and our 27 member states, there's a lot for us to do.
Just a little look back on the year. The pandemic has impacted everybody's way of work and way of living. And one thing we've got very, very used to is having meetings in parks. Where have you been in London and who have you met? Have you met Boris Johnson? Have you met Dominic Raab? Have you met Michael Gove?
I did meet Michael Gove several times. I met a few other ministers. I haven't met the Prime Minister or the Foreign Secretary yet. And I even travel around the country. I went to Northern Ireland. I went to Wales. I had a virtual visit to Scotland. This was quite a special year. But still, if we focus on the essence of things, I would say, I think we have to take stock of the fact that we have a new kind of relationship and that we have to do to make the most out of it. And that's the focus that I'm taking and my team. But also, I would say, I hope that the next 12 months will be better from that point of view.
You mentioned there that you have been to Northern Ireland. Now, Northern Ireland, as you know, has been an incredible cause of tension in the Brexit relationship, which is also threatening the relationship in the UK. And we've had 5 nights of violence, disruption in Northern Ireland. I can see from the police statements over the weekend that we're talking small loyalist gatherings in certain communities. It's not widespread, but I wouldn't underestimate its significance in that many people, including people in the EU and in Ireland, who some of whom you may know, talk about how unstable Northern Ireland has been. What is your view of what's happened over the last 3 months?
When British people voted for Brexit and the British government opted for a simultaneous departure from the single market and from the customs union, we all knew that Northern Ireland would be the most intricate issue to solve. The result of that is the Northern Ireland protocol attached to the withdrawal agreement. And it took a few years to negotiate. I can guarantee you from listening to those who negotiated that they turned every stone to try to find alternatives to this protocol. No one came with a better idea. Even those who attack the protocol today would like to see it scrapped, have no alternative to the protocol. And we agreed between us and our British friends those measures in December. Well, the fact is that they have not yet been fully implemented by the authorities. And that's where we should start, in our view, is to implement what we have agreed. And once we've done that, and that once we've shown commitment to do that and action to translate that into practical terms, then we can look at other possible measures of flexibility in order to address the problem. So the protocol is not the problem. The protocol is the solution for the problems created by Brexit.
I think everybody who's followed this and I've been following it for 4.5 years,
yeah,
is aware of the EU's sense of very deep sense of duty of care to the people of Northern Ireland. It was the EU way more than the UK, which spoke so passionately about the fragility of peace, about the need to protect the peace process, etc. But I would like to ask you whether the EU actually misjudged the impact of implementing the Northern Ireland Protocol in its entirety, bar a few grace periods for supermarkets, parcels, medicines, on the 1st of January? And would it not have been better had the EU, perhaps even unilaterally, given a grace period for the whole implementation and have a transition period?
I do understand the sensitivity, and we've been very, very much open and very much flexible to that. But let's not forget the origin of the issues, right? We are talking about the impact of Brexit. We are talking about the impact of the departure from the single market, which was decided on the British side as well. So decisions have consequences. The British government decided to take unilateral action. Unilateral decisions are no solutions for these problems. The problems must be found together. That's why we created a number of bodies where we sit down together with our British friends. But they chose to walk out of those bodies and to take unilateral action, which is not good. This being said, we have had to take legal action, as you know. We received some lists of measures that the UK authorities intend to implement. We had asked for a roadmap. We are not assessing those measures to see how we can move forward. So things have changed and people need to adapt. But also in some other areas, things will never be the same as they were before. I see in the deal, in the agreement, the potential for deep and wide and a very dynamic relationship between the EU and UK. We should all focus in making the most out of this agreement.
To move to the vaccine, I hear you've been back in Brussels and you've got your vaccine, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm waiting for my second jab, yes.
What did you have?
Pfizer.
Pfizer. Did you have a choice?
No, it was under the Belgian system, according to, I don't know, whatever criteria they use, but I took the jab they gave me.
Would you have taken the AstraZeneca one?
I took the one they gave me. There was no decision on me to do that.
The vaccine wars have been extraordinary, haven't they? But I suppose the big question that everybody's asking, just ordinary people and voters, is when will the EU catch up with the UK?
Well, our hope, first of all, I don't think we should make this a beauty contest. I think it's even immoral to, hold a beauty contest on the back of a tragedy and the pandemics like this one. So we are not in the business of seeing who's doing better or not. I think everybody needs to get it done, because you are only safe if your neighbor is safe. So the success on one side of the border is the success for the other side of the border. Our hope is still to achieve our goal by the end of summer. Some people say that maybe even before that. Let's see. I hope the sooner the better, of course. And we remain confident that we can speed up vaccinations in the second quarter as compared to the first quarter. And let's hope that both the UK and the EU achieve their goals and life will be better after summer.
And then, of course, the big question will be, if the whole of Europe is vaccinated, what sort of intensification of sharing the vaccine around the world through COVAX? Have you any info on that?
Well, we are the world's number one exporter of vaccines, by far. The latest figures I have is that we have exported, since the end of January, up to now, exported 68 million doses to 41 different destinations, of which around 11 million to the United Kingdom. And at the same time, we are delivering vaccines through the COVAX mechanisms to 92 low and middle income countries around the world. So our track record is absolutely top, and we'll continue to do so because we believe this is our responsibility.
Final question. Have you booked a holiday yet?
Portugal is definitely my home country, and this is where I intend to spend my holidays. But we haven't booked anything yet. I think we need to be to wait and see how things develop. But I do hope that we all can, including you, Lisa, and all our friends listening, all have some time to rest during holidays. I think our countries are doing a great job in trying to address this pandemic, but there's still a lot of effort. And I can tell you from the European Union side, this is our top priority right now.
The Guardian's Lisa O'Carroll speaking to João Valéz de Almeida. And that's all from us this week. Make sure to listen to Friday's episode of Politics Weekly Extra as Jonathan Friedland speaks to Peter Wehner of the Ethics and Public Policy Center in DC about the hypocrisy of the Christian right in the wake of the scandal surrounding Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz. Make sure to look out for that in the Politics Weekly feed wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Gabby Hinsliff, Lisa O'Carroll, Peter Walker, João Valéz de Almeida, Kai Taylor and Andrew Fewings. The producer is Danielle Stevens, and I'm Raphael Baer. Please look after yourselves, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.